Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behavior in a practical, fun, and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting, or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well. What tips do they have for you and I? And I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Today, I have the great pleasure of chatting to a woman who has moved from working largely in her profession of clinical psychology to working on her profession and helping to enhance the well-being and fulfill the potential of future leaders in her field. Dr. Tess Crawley is a clinical and forensic psychologist from Hobart, Tasmania. She spent more than 10 years mentoring other psychologists, and she's seen the challenges that even the experts face in balancing work and life and well-being. She's a former university lecturer and now the director of a busy multi-location private psychology practice. She's a former actor and owner of her own theatre company. She's a mum and she's a woman of much energy and enthusiasm. Welcome, Tess.
Hi, Ellen. So glad to be here. Thanks for that intro.
You're very welcome. I think I'm getting more flamboyant with my intros as I go along, but absolutely accurate and well-deserved. Tess, can you tell us a little bit about your background as a psychologist, because you're both a clinical and forensic psychologist, and probably our listeners don't really have a good grasp of what either of those do.
Yeah, okay. So to take it right back to, I didn't go to university until I was 25, so I was busy being an actor and doing all sorts of fun things, and I was actually drawn to criminology as my first thought when I decided to go to university. I'm from Tassie originally, but was living in Melbourne at the time and sat on the floor of our apartment with this great big massive book that they used to give you, which is the course outline. Of course, it's all online now. Thumbing through it and, of course, found no course for criminology. And I was like, oh. So I then had to choose between law and psychology. So I ummed and ahed about the different units within each of those courses, and just psychology spoke to me a little bit more. And I decided that I would study to become a clinical psychologist, which is somebody who diagnoses and treats mental illness predominantly. That's the sort of the, in a nutshell, description of a clinical psych, but with a forensic focus. And forensic psychology is just that joining of psychology and the law. So how that works now is that most of my work, most of my treatment work is in the perinatal field with, you know, pregnancy, fertility, adjustment to parenting, and the forensic side of that is around the family court. So I'm often called upon to give evidence and reports to the family court or for child protection or things like that. So I've got this interesting mix of the two going on. But I've worked in prisons. I've done all that gritty forensic work as well, and it has certainly been an interesting journey, which I've really enjoyed.
Yeah, absolutely. I think even for me, although I'm a psychologist, the idea particularly of going to court, I think that legal side of thing perhaps creates a little bit of fear in the heart of many of us who have not had exposure to that. I've done some work with prisons as well from a workforce point of view, so I'm sort of more comfortable with that. But the idea of going to court, and I'm guessing probably, you know, there's some tricky situations, some tricky cases that you've had to work on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, most psychologists would rather be alone in a room with a murderer than alone in a courtroom full of lawyers. And that's just, you know, it presses all our buttons about what's that process going to look like. And of course, we've only got Hollywood to show us because we don't have much opportunity to see inside a courtroom. And Hollywood likes to dramatize things. And I have to say, it's usually a lot less boring and a lot more polite than what we see in the films.
Interesting. Yes, I do love a legal drama myself, but yeah, probably not an accurate depiction of what it's like. Okay. So, and what led you to supervise other psychologists? And I suppose a lot of, again, for our listeners, you know, the term supervision in psychology and in a lot of the mental health fields and medical fields, we sort of have an understanding of what that means. But what does supervision mean?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because a lot of people assume that you've done something wrong if you need to have a supervisor. You need to be supervised. We think about supervising children. Children must be under supervision. Our profession, as you know, requires of us that we participate in supervision to maintain or to attain certain levels of our profession. And supervision really is about seeking out a mentor, seeking out somebody who can guide you in your practice and support you in your practice while you're continuing to find your feet. So I started out supervising research students at the University of Tasmania, and there was nobody to teach me how to do that role. I had to pick that up as I went along. I did have supervisors myself, so I learnt a little bit from them. And then over the course of the years, I've had students in my practice, so postgraduate psychology students in my practice, and supervising them and supervising my own team as my team has grown. And so that's fed into a real interest in mentoring other mental health professionals, supporting them. And so I make a distinction between supervision and mentoring, because I think supervision has very specific connotations in our profession, and I do offer that as well. But the mentoring is much more about supporting and unlocking confidence and personal development within those professionals as they move through their career into more senior and leadership type roles.
Interesting, you know, from my experience as a workplace psychologist, this idea of having somebody, you know, some people are very fortunate to have formal or informal mentors, say perhaps people who are more experienced who are able to guide them. Many people don't, you know, they're certainly early in your career, you're good at what you do, and so you get elevated or promoted to a leadership role or a management role, and then you're left really to figure it out for yourself. So what you're doing, therefore, is really providing people with a more structured way to gain that expertise, that guidance, the support, a sounding board, I'm guessing, whilst they do find their feet. And I think, even though we think of that perhaps in the context of an early career professional, most of us will be struck, you know, people are complex. So most of us will be struck by challenging situations, managing and supervising other staff as careers progress. Would that be right?
That's absolutely right. Because what happens as we progress through our career, we go through that early flush of I've just graduated and feeling a little bit of an imposter, and I have to have a supervisor if I want to become endorsed in a particular area of my field. And that's whether you're a clinical psychologist or you're a forensic psychologist or you're an educational psychologist. The lay term would be specialised areas of practice. We're not allowed to use that term, of course, but I think your listeners will understand what we mean when we say that. But then there's often that transitional period where clinicians have their confidence about their skill set as treating psychologists and they feel the need for supervision wane. Then they move further on into their career where they are in leadership roles and they find themselves at the top of the tree, whether that's in their practice or within the team that they're working in government or wherever, and they don't have anybody else at that level to bounce off. And that's where a lot of people get stuck. And I know for myself, going back 12 months ago, so I have a mentor as well. So I mentor others, but I also have a mentor. And before I met my mentor, so 12 months ago, I was on holidays with my family in Japan, set up to have a visit with an English language speaking psychology practice over there, spent the day with their team leader. And I said to her, you wouldn't believe that I've had to come to the other side of the world to find somebody else that I can talk to at this level. So that was a really, I guess, an eye-opener for me. If I felt that, no doubt many other psychologists and other mental health professionals at that level of leadership would feel the same. And I have no doubt that's the same in other professions, not just the mental health professions. It's true what they say. It's lonely, you know, when you get up to those top levels in career.
Yeah, absolutely. So what are the sorts of challenges from your experience that psychologists, other mental health professionals, and I suspect, as you say, many other professionals in different fields face when they get to that point? They've developed their expertise in their content area, but now they're faced with dealing with managing and supervising other people. What are the challenges?
I think certainly if I use private psychology practice as an example, it's probably the clearest example I can give, because you've trained so long to be a mental health professional and you've done so much work in training beyond university, so workshops and all sorts of things that you participate in, engaging in supervision. You're really skilled at what you do with your clients. Then you move into a leadership role, whether that might be, as a private practice owner, for example, you've suddenly got a business to run and nobody's taught you how to run a business. You've got marketing to do. Nobody's taught you how to do marketing. You've got a team that you want to build. No one's taught you how to recruit people. No one's taught you how to manage an administration staff, and so on and so on and so on. So like, I make the distinction that I'm not a business coach. I'm not a business mentor. Some of the work I do does touch on those elements, of course, because a number of my mentoring clientele are private practice owners, but they're not all private practice owners. So what I'm doing is unlocking those barriers to confidence, I guess, that come out of, I've never done this before, therefore I can't do it, or therefore I'm not going to be any good at this. I think also when you're leading a team, when you've stepped out of being a peer and you're now leading a team, there is that fear that you don't know all the answers that you, inverted commas, should know. And there's that risk that we expect ourselves to know everything and then beat ourselves up when we don't, because we can't know everything. So, it can be quite isolating. I think that is, like as I said before, I think that's one of the other big factors there in any profession.
Yeah, and I guess the thing that came to mind then when we were talking is this notion of a bit of the imposter syndrome, this idea that, you know, I'm in charge now, therefore I should know everything and be capable of doing everything. And inwardly I'm thinking, I have no idea, but other people are looking at me like I'm the boss and I do feel like an imposter.
Yeah, and that is incredibly common, and I think that's probably the biggest fear that people have as they're moving into leading a team or building a team, because it's that spotlight on you. You're the bunny in the headlights, and it's hard sometimes to say, I don't know the answer, but I will find it out. But I think once you throw those words around a little bit, you get better at it, and I think that teams really respond well when you know your own limits to knowledge and expertise and you're quite comfortable saying, I've reached the limit of my knowledge and expertise, but I'll find somebody else who can either do that for us or provide that answer for us. And that's true leadership.
It is, isn't it? And I think that's interesting. When I work with workplaces, I quite often tell people that they need to take their manager hat off and just be a human being and relate to people in that way as another human being, to say, you know what, exactly as you say, I don't know all the answers here, but I accept that it's my responsibility to find out, and let's, you know, see what we can do to come up with the answer or the best solution. And people do respond to that.
Yeah, right.
So that's one strategy that you might use to help build someone's confidence and start to open up the possibility that they don't need to know the answers, which I think is quite freeing. What other tips or strategies do you use with your mentoring or mentees, your, you know, clientele to help them through these barriers?
So what I will do also is I'll also get them looking a little bit inwardly and looking at in what other areas of their lives have they felt barriers to achieving what they've wanted to achieve, and identifying what those barriers have been and identifying ways to overcome those. So in my mentoring group that I run at the moment, I think it was the very first task I set them. It was, I asked them the question, you know, who first told you couldn't do something and that you really wanted to do? And I told them the story of when I was in grade 2 and we had a, I think I've written a blog post on this actually, and we had a relief teacher, and she went around the class, all this, you know, smiling 7-year-olds, and asked everybody what they wanted to be when they grew up, and came to my turn. And I said I wanted to be an explorer. And she just looked at me and said, well, you can't, because all the countries have already been discovered. So just shut me down. I never forgot it. And I often think about that experience for me in terms of, you know, how many young people have dreams, whatever they might be, and are told, no, you can't, for whatever reason. And what does that set us up for later? And what voice do we hear when we're telling ourselves that we can't achieve something or other? So, you know, we look at unpicking and unpacking some of those internal stories and working on those. We look at, I challenge them to step outside their comfort zone sometimes. So that might be, I think that this week their challenge was to introduce themselves to each other with a live stream video, because my clientele at the moment are from all around Australia and we meet each week on Facebook Live. So I got them doing it too, you know, do a live video into the group, introduce yourself, show us your practice, tell us your story, tell us what's holding you back, tell us what you want to achieve. And it's incredibly confronting for some people to do that, but they feel incredibly empowered afterwards. So, you know, there are lots of strategies that we work through together to prove, I guess, to them that it's warranted that they should feel confident in their skills and their leadership ability.
Wonderful. And so this is part of your program. You mentioned it then, which is Quiet Confidence.
Well, there's a couple of different programs. So we have I have a group that started out being called Quiet Confidence for Emerging Supervisors, but I've changed the name to Quiet Confidence Foundations because I didn't want everybody thinking they had to be a psychology supervisor to be a member of that group. So once I clarified that, it made it easier for people to sort of get their heads around what it was for. And later on in the year, I'll be launching a very small group program, very intensive program, which is called Quiet Confidence, Confident Like a Boss. And that is for people who are right at that leadership level and ready to take themselves to the next level in confidence and leadership development. So, yeah, it's an area that I really enjoy working in. I get a lot of pleasure out of watching these clinicians make that transition from, you know, confident in their ability to treat individual people is very different to being confident in that area of leading others and inspiring others.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, I think I know what you're saying is very applicable to conversations that I've had in people in workplaces that are varied and diverse and not necessarily in the mental health or clinical field. But I'm wondering how this applies also just these notions of confidence and leadership in other areas beyond perhaps our work.
I think so. I think you're right. I mean, a lot of my clinical work is with families in perinatal, specifically the perinatal field. And I guess transition is a major focus of what I do, both with my clinical clients and my mentoring clients. So watching couples make that transition to becoming parents, it's an incredibly privileged position for me as a clinician to be in, because I'm right there with them as they explore their lack of confidence and their anxieties and their fears and their feelings of not being good enough, and watching them and encouraging them to gain some confidence, to learn about their baby and to learn about reading the cues of their baby and trusting their own instincts. I think that's probably the bridge between both of these areas, is teaching people to trust their own instincts. As a race, we have instincts for a reason. As a species, I should say, you know, we have instincts for a reason. They've served us well. We talk about evolution, but in the modern world, we're taught we should, you know, squash those down and not listen to those. And so I encourage people to do the opposite. Hear them, hear them, explore them.
Yeah, and that is applicable. I think this is really the essence of kind of being human, I suppose, this idea that we all transition, that, you know, whether it's a career or stepping into a different career, stepping into parenthood, stepping into different phases of parenthood. You know, I'm starting to kind of look down the barrel of kids starting high school in the next couple of years. That's another kind of scary proposition, teenage years, you know, marriage and partnership, moving into state. You know, we all go through lots and lots of different transitions over our lifetimes, and to do it successfully does require vulnerability and courage and confidence. So I can see that these concepts that you're talking about apply across a whole lot of different areas.
They do. They absolutely do. And you talk about, you know, transitions in life generally, people moving houses, people changing jobs, people moving into retirement. I remember watching my grandfather retire. He was a builder, and I watched him uncouple himself very sadly from relationships that he thought were friendships, but in hindsight were just working relationships. And that was a very difficult transition for him to make. And that stood out to me. And I was probably in my late teens, early 20s at that stage. And it was sad to watch. So that notion of transition is, you know, like working in the prisons. You know, the most dangerous time in a prisoner's life is while they're making that transition into prison life. And then eventually they settle and their risk variables reduce somewhat. The transition and change is such tricky areas, and transitioning or traversing those transitions without support can be fraught.
Yeah, and so this, having a mentor, having a support, having somebody there, and I suppose in many ways that's the essence of what a lot of us do as psychologists. You know, you mentioned change there, and really behaviour change is fundamental to what the profession does. So having somebody there, whether it's in the capacity you've been speaking about, so part of a kind of a formal mentoring type program to help people move into leadership, whether it's coming to see a perinatal psychologist in the, you know, transition to parenthood, whether it's trying to make any change or come to grips perhaps with a change that we didn't choose, is very much one of our roles, isn't it?
Yeah, Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah. So what is it that really drew you to wanting to help people through this? What's the kind of greater purpose for you, I suppose, in not only your program, but in dealing with all of this work in transition?
Yeah, I think I remember when I was lecturing, and I remember lecturing to first-year students and, you know, the background as an actor sort of came forward there and you know, nothing like a live audience. And, you know, 400 students in a room, and it was my goal to entertain them. I didn't want bored students in my lectures. And the reason behind that was I wanted to motivate, if it was only just one more student, that I'm motivated to become a psychologist for the right reasons. Because, of course, you meet lots of people in life who think, I'll be a great psychologist because everyone comes to me with their problems, and that's not necessarily always going to pan out. But if I could, you know, motivate and inspire at least one more student to become a psychologist and to help people in the community, then, you know, I've done a great job. And that was my motivation then, and it remains my motivation now, to inspire wellness in my clients, to inspire great parenting in my perinatal clients, and to inspire, you know, my mentoring clientele. My key goal there is to inspire them to be able to, and confident to inspire other clinicians further down the experience ladder, that multi-generational inspiration to lead and to provide a great service and to do a great job for the community. So it sounds very lofty when I say it out loud, but that's really what's behind it all, you know, that I really want to encourage others to continue to encourage others.
Yeah. And I think that's a wonderful ambition. And, you know, we know that meaning and purpose is really, well, the best description I have heard for a sense of meaning and purpose, the one that's most meaningful for me, is this idea that we're giving back to something greater than ourselves. So I can see that really coming through very strongly in your description there of giving back to not just your profession, but to the community more broadly, to be able to develop these clinicians, these mental health professionals and other psychologists, to be able to serve their own communities, to be able to help and assist and provide support to the individuals in their communities.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful. So that kind of leads me then to some thoughts and ideas on well-being. You know, again, purpose as a psychologist is to be able to create mental health and well-being in others. What are, and this may be for your program clients, but also for other clients that you've dealt with, what do you see as the key things that everybody can do to really enhance their mental health and well-being?
I think it depends on the day you ask me what my top three tips would be.
Today's top three tips.
When I'm talking to the general population, I generally say, you know, make sure that you have support. So you have somebody that you can talk to, and make sure that you are taking good care of yourself. You know, those stock standard self-care tips, you know, they're cliche because, you know, because they work. You know, people talk about it a lot because they work. You know, good sleep, good nutrition, exercise, all those things. But when I'm talking to people in leadership roles, I add to that a couple of extra elements. The thing I notice most about mental health professionals, particularly those in private practice, but this would happen in any small business setting, I expect, is not taking enough breaks because, of course, time is money. So people working hours that are too long, not taking holidays, not having downtime. And I think also fear of delegating, fear that things won't be done well. And so they hold too much tightly to their chest and create unsustainable workloads for themselves. So I talk to my mentoring clientele, but also to people in, and I have had clients in the past in other leadership roles, and I talk to them about a couple of things. The first is delegating, of course. Knowing your limits, I think, is very important, whether that's your time limits, setting some boundaries around that and having those boundaries really clearly understood by those around you. And I do that by having a few days a week where I don't work from the office. I work from home or from a cafe if I feel a bit naughty. And that allows me to focus on the work I need to get done. I love supporting my team, but if I'm in the office, that's all I end up spending my time doing, and that's okay, but I also have other things I need to do. So I need to set those boundaries and maintain those boundaries. But I also talk to people about diversification. So if you're in a profession that has the scope, and psychology is a great example of this, that has the scope for you to work in lots of different areas and do lots of different things that keep you motivated and keep you remembering what you loved about this profession to start with, making sure that you expose yourself to opportunities to diversify within your profession, and that keeps your energy up, that keeps you feeling motivated and excited and joyful about the work that you're doing. And then I think the other point was to, I guess, adding to that or related to that is knowing what your passion areas are and making sure that you spend time in those passion areas. So for me, writing is a passion area. I've been a writer a lot longer than way before I was a psychologist. And so more recently, I've been spending a lot more time writing, and it's all to do with my profession now. So I'm marrying the two. But I've found a way through blog posts and things like that to be able to be creative in the writing that I do and reach a broader audience that way. And that's very fulfilling to me.
Yeah, I think they're wonderful. But I love this notion of diversification, because I think, you know, it's something that I hold, perhaps I diversify a bit too much some weeks, hold dear to my heart, you know, that I have lots of different projects, lots of different things that go on, because it does give you that motivation that, and some of us like variety more than others. But, you know, what struck me again when you were speaking about that is that I think that's applicable to everyday life. You know, we can so easily get stuck in routines of get up, go to work, go home, feed the kids, you know, go to bed. Or if you are at home, you know, just doing the same things day in, day out, which I think human beings are probably not really designed to do over the longer term. I think we do need variety. I think we need other people. We need different interests. We need different passions. And we need to remind ourselves, because particularly work life is sort of not structured for variety and diversity as a general rule. Those of us who work for ourselves, you know, can see the benefits and we're able to implement that. And I'm actually working with a client at the moment. They're moving into what's called activity-based working, which, you know, is a bit of a fraught issue for a lot of people. But for me, the notion of actually saying, right, I'm going to not sit at the same desk every day. I'm going to go and work in a different spot. Even if it's a different desk, I will go and sit next to a different person. I will have a conversation with someone that I don't normally talk to, is so important to being able to maintain that motivation and passion for what we do and interest in learning and growth. So I think that's a wonderful tip for all of us.
Yeah. And that's not something that's talked about an awful lot. I think there's, you know, we could drown in all the self-help options around motivation and finding your passion and all of that sort of stuff. But it really comes down to looking inwards and saying, what fills me up? What brings me joy? What actually excites me and motivates me? How do I bring that into my, at least my every week, if not my every day, and go from there and explore it, and don't be so fearful of failure. Somebody commented the other day on something that I was looking at on Twitter, said that fear of failure is emotionally dishonest, and the subtext being that it's actually other things we're fearful of. And I think people are fearful of being judged. So fearful of being judged for stepping outside of your normal everyday, or being judged for stepping outside of your comfort zone, which means you're also probably stepping into what would be a discomfort zone for other people. Fear of being judged to have failed. And I think for Australians, fear of being judged for getting above your station. You know, the tall poppy thing is alive and well in this country. And of course, you know, you would have the same experience, I'm sure, you know, those of us in the psychology profession in particular who are moving more and more into the social media platforms, there's a little bit of a taboo around that in our profession, and it takes a little bit of gumption to push through that. I don't know if you ever get over it, but you do need to push through that sometimes, because for me and for you, Ellen, I'm sure it's all about increasing knowledge in the community and making psychology more accessible and things like that. That's important to me. That's one of my values. So I think if people can look at what their core values are and look at what brings them joy and excitement and see how they can work that into their every week, if not their every day.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. I mean, that's the very reason why I have created this podcast is to be able to share the experience and share the stories and share the knowledge of psychologists and other related fields so that we can provide that to other people, because I think there's so much to know and to learn and such wonderful tips like the ones you've given, you know, that as a profession, we perhaps haven't been very good at sharing those, but you've got to be prepared to put your head above the radar a little bit And that does take courage.
Indeed. And I think also, you know, with our training, you know, we're taught that we must, if we put anything on paper, it must be fully referenced back to original research articles, and it must be fully researched before you open your mouth, all these sorts of things. Well, that's fine in an academic sphere. And I think that we've reached a point now in our society where there is free and ready and easy access to any information you like on the internet. You can follow any YouTube star you like who's a self-help guru of some sort or another, or you can have a trained mental health professional who's had the training behind them to provide, you know, similar information, but you know that it's coming from a source with a background in the training. We don't need to bore people to tears with all of the referenced articles that our training has come out of. That's not the interesting bit. Is what do you do when you're anxious? What do you do if you're depressed? The interesting bit is how do I know if, you know, if I'm experiencing postnatal depression or it's just the baby blues? So this is, I think, a new world for our profession, and I give it, you know, another bunch of years and everybody will be doing it and feeling a lot more comfortable about it.
Yeah, and I can imagine that that's perhaps one of the core themes of the programs that you run is starting to give people the confidence to be able to speak more generally to the community, not just to an individual client that they might have in front of them in order to be able to spread this word.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Now, here's a question for you. What would you recommend? You know, what are your top, say, couple of books that you have found? And these could be in any field. So whether it's kind of related specifically to mental health or more generally to some of the topics we've been talking about, confidence or even, you know, small business. What are your top recommendations?
Okay, books. Now you get me going. I'm a bookophile. In fact, our little holiday house that we are renovating at the moment is a former library, and we are running out of room for even our books there.
You've got a library full of books.
We've got a library full of books that's overflowing. I'm a great one for buying books and not reading them. I have a lovely collection of books. So I have moved with the times a little and have gotten into listening to audiobooks. So there are a couple of books at the moment that I talk about a lot. One is The 5-Second Rule by Mel Robbins. I think for people who are anxious or lacking confidence or getting in their own way from taking a step forward in life, she uses some principles in that are very similar to what we would do in cognitive behavioral therapy. It's basically about overriding the inner monologue that's telling you not to do something that you really want to do. So it might be, for example, that you want to get healthy, but you, every time your alarm goes off in the morning, you hit the snooze button because, oh, I just can't today. And she bursts through that. You know, she says you've got 5 seconds basically to burst through that and just do it, do the thing. And she's one of those speakers, you know, one of those very popular on the internet people. She's a lawyer, she's a broadcaster, she's not a psychologist, but she's got a team behind her with very solid research. And of course, watching her stuff as a psychologist, I'm impressed to say there's probably only been one time where I've cringed when she said something that I didn't quite think was right. So she's pretty good. She's very, very approachable and very easy read / listen if you're an audiobook person. The other book that I encourage people to have a look at is Mindset by Carol Dweck. That is a book all about what I talk about with my clientele. You're having a look at the mindset that is holding you back. And I think this is a book that's approachable for most people as well. And I also encourage people to look at absolutely anything written by Brené Brown. She's a fabulous writer. She's clinical social worker, researcher, and looks at vulnerability and the power in not being perfect. Really good read, really nurturing but also empowering. And then finally, for those in business, if you haven't gotten on to Gary Vaynerchuk, I want to know why. he's very loud, he's very American, he's very much an Eddie Everywhere, as we would say here, and he's got some great books that talk about putting yourself out there, finding where your zone is, finding your passion area and just going hell for leather with it. So the two books that are, I guess, bookends of this concept that he talks mostly about is his first one was called Crush It and his current one is called Crushing It. And it's about using social media to build up a business based on your passion. So, for example, you might be working in an insurance job, but your passion is writing, or your passion is making little videos about Lego. And he's all about, well, if you do it right, if you spend enough time in that passion area, you can actually make it your main area of work and pleasure. So he's interesting. I find him very interesting, and especially if you're not really familiar with social media and you want to figure out how it is that people make money out of doing that. It's a very interesting area of reading. I think teaching people to get it, again, to get out of their own way when it comes to assumptions that social media is for teenagers, and a lot of big businesses have gone under because they weren't quick enough to get their heads around the internet and social media and all that sort of stuff. So it is interesting from a business perspective to hear what he's got to say.
Yeah, and I think they're all wonderful recommendations. I know of all of them, and I fully agree with all of them as great sources of information. And interesting that, you know, quite an array there. And I think that's, you know, when we're talking about passion, when we're talking about purpose, values, when we're talking about confidence, that there are so many different ways to access these concepts, and so many great experts out there who can help us with that. And you're doing that yourself with your programs within the mental health and clinical field, so which is wonderful. And what I really need to know, and what our listeners need to know, is where they can find out more about you and what you do. Because as you said, you do write, you've got these programs, but you're also the director of a multi-location team across Tasmania. So tell us, where do we find you?
My team is based, our head office is based in Hobart. So we have a website, tesscrawley.com.au, and on there you can find out about my team of clinicians. We have, I think it's 14 at last count. We've got a head office in Hobart. We've got another office in Launceston, and we do rural outreach for a number of rural centres in Tassie, right down the east coast of Tassie, which is a hard job to take. I can tell you it's a beautiful part of the world. So the website is probably really good for a call for people who want to find out a bit of everything about what I do, because there's also a tab on there for mental health professionals, so you can find out about my mentoring programs there. I'm all over Facebook, so if you search for me in Facebook, you'll find my Quiet Confidence page. I have some groups that are free groups for mental health clinicians. So there's the Meeting Room, which is for all mental health professionals. There's Rural Psychology Professionals, Rural Mental Health Professionals page for people specifically in rural practice, Psychology Supervisors Australia. There's a whole number of them, and they all have my name attached to them. So if you're searching in groups with my name, you'll find those. I have a blog on Psych Central, which is an American website all about psychology and mental health, and my blog is called Stigma Rebellion. This is all about bursting through stigma, both for general mental health in the community, but also around mental health professionals accessing their own confidence and coming and speaking up when they need assistance too. So you can search for that one on the internet. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram, and I'm on YouTube. So I've got most of them covered, but as I said to you before, Ellen, the next step is a podcast, and we'll get that one covered
coming
too.
Soon.
Coming soon. As soon as my microphone arrives.
It's so much fun. It's so much fun. You'll have a ball. And I will make sure that I put links to all, well, perhaps not all of them. I'm not sure I'll cover every single Facebook group because, as you said, you're everywhere. But certainly all of those, you know, the website, your Psych Central blog, which I think is a fabulous resource for people, and those other social media links, so that we can all find you. Also to your recommended books, which are brilliant too. So
that was a good question to ask me on the fly, and I'm glad I came up with something sensible as an answer.
Just thought I'd keep you on your toes.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Tess, for all of your time and your input. I feel a kindred spirit in you in terms of, you know, wanting to talk about psychology as a profession and being able to help people more broadly in our communities with their confidence, with their skills, with their knowledge, which I am personally passionate about, and I think is a wonderful aim and goal. But also just to have a kindred spirit in somebody who's prepared to put their head above the parapet a little bit. And be brave and be, you know, prepared to put ourselves in spheres and forums that psychologists traditionally haven't been. And I'm hoping that that does, and particularly through your programs, that this whole idea of mentoring helps others to do the same, and perhaps more broadly from psychology into some of the other professions too, so that we can all help fulfill the potential of all of our communities.
Absolutely. And my absolute pleasure to be here, Ellen. I've really enjoyed it. So thank you so much for inviting me. It makes it a great fun.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you. What a wonderful conversation with Dr. Tess Crawley of Dr. Tess Crawley and Associates. I am always inspired by people who are out there trying something different and new. And Tess is doing that in spades in creating her online mentoring program and really putting her passion and purpose into practice to help new leaders in the mental health field fulfill their potential and build a better community for all of us. You can find out more about Tess and the program she runs in the show notes for this episode. Just go to potential.com.au/podcast. There, you'll also find a link to Tess's blog, The Stigma Rebellion, on Psych Central, as well as her social media links and the great books she's recommended in today's episode. As we do for every guest, we've also put together a guest profile sheet, and this contains Tess's tips for well-being. That's yours to download in the show notes. An extra big thank you today to everyone who has taken the time to email or message me to tell me how much you're enjoying the podcast. This wonderful feedback is great motivation to me and the team to keep going. I'm particularly grateful to those of you who have taken the time to write a review of the show in iTunes. Thank you. If you're not already, you can follow Potential Psychology on Facebook and on Instagram. I post links to my favourite articles on the topics of well-being, positive psychology, mindset, parenting, work and success on Facebook, and Instagram stories will give you a sneak peek into the daily life here at Potential HQ, as well as keeping you up to date on my upcoming podcast guests. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week for episode 8.